This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Coming up a little later in the program, we'll hear about why Ohio has been named a top tornado state and how we can prepare. First, will President Joe Biden's name appear on the Ohio ballot in November? State law requires the ballot be certified 90 days before an election, but the Democratic National Convention happens after that deadline. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost is rejecting a plan from Democrats to get Biden's name on the ballot. Joining me to talk through how all of this is playing out is political reporter for the USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau, Haley B. Miller. Hi, Haley.
Hi. Happy Friday.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks so much for being here today. To get started, I think we need to explain a little bit about why it's an issue for President Biden to get his name on the ballot in November. What are the rules and what's the problem?
Yeah, so Ohio certifies the ballot for its elections 90 days beforehand, which is August 7th this year. And the DNC is scheduled to take place, I think, August 19th to the 22nd or something. So the Secretary of State has said that Democrats need to figure out a way to either change when they're going to certify the president, or Ohio needs to change its laws temporarily to deal with this timing issue, because the Secretary of State says that he can't certify Biden for the ballot under the current guardrails.
Now, in the past, this has happened, right? And what did they do in those years?
Yeah, so the legislature has basically temporarily changed the deadlines before. This happened in 2020 with both parties, actually. Both conventions were after Ohio's deadline. So they changed it to a 60-day window, I believe, for ballot certification, which got, you know, Ohio passed the convention, and that was all resolved. And, you know, worth noting, too, that Ohio does have a really early deadline compared to some states, which I think is part of why we find ourselves in this pickle.
So let's talk a little bit about what the Democrats have proposed, because they had a proposal for a way to make this work out. What did they suggest?
They said that they could certify Biden provisionally before Ohio's August 7th deadline, and then turn around after the convention and just confirm the results. The thinking there being, you know, we all know Biden is going to be the one on the ballot. He's a Democratic nominee here and he has enough delegates. So this would just be kind of a technical workaround to address the deadline. But the Attorney General's office has said that that is not allowed under state law, and kind of threw cold water on that proposal.
So here we are wondering what's going to happen. And then Republican Senate President Matt Huffman spoke to our partners at the State House News Bureau and said there's no change to Ohio's deadline that a federal if there is no change to Ohio's deadline, a federal court may have to step in.
Or folks who say, well, we can keep Joe Biden off the ballot. That's wrong. I think you're not going to be able to look at the current president of the United States and a major political candidate and just say, we got a law, you didn't know about it, ha ha.
So he's saying, hey, we're going to have to figure this out. What are you hearing, and what's your reaction to those comments from Senate President Matt Huffman?
So he, you know, kind of at the beginning of this, he said that this was a Democratic problem and it requires a Democratic solution. Now you're hearing him say, this is going to get it figured out. It's just a matter of how. He thinks that the DNC can do this procedurally, but there is also conversation about whether Ohio will pursue legislative recourse again, like we did in 2020, and no official word yet on whether any legislation is coming down the pipeline. Democrats have said previously that they're kind of waiting on guidance from the Biden campaign and the DNC. There's at least one lawmaker out there who has said he could have something ready if that's what they decide they want to do. Huffman also said, which I, not that I'm a lawyer, but I think this is a fair assessment of the situation, that if this did go into litigation, that Democrats would likely be successful because we just saw the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, maintain Trump's status on the ballot.
In Colorado. That came up in Colorado. Right. And Washington State and Alabama apparently also have this issue.
Yeah, and they're doing their own thing. The Washington Secretary of State is a Democrat, and he has said that he will accept provisional approval, like the Democrats tried to do here. And then in Alabama, legislation is working its way through the process to address the issue. And based on reporting that I've seen, it looks like it has bipartisan support. The Secretary of State there is not willing to do the provisional thing, so that's why they're pursuing that avenue.
So now that we know what's happening, what do you think are the next steps? I mean, what do you think the next thing to happen will be in the effort to get President Biden on the ballot?
It's hard to say at this point because, I mean, I think everyone is exploring various options. Like I said, I think at least one lawmaker has legislation ready to go if that ends up being the course that they want to take. And my sense is that, you know, the Senate president is open to that if Democrats bring him a proposal. Republicans aren't like sitting there working on one themselves, but I think they would work with Democrats to get that passed. No real word yet from Biden and the DNC on whether they're considering a lawsuit at this point or if that could be imminent. And I'm not an expert in like DNC procedural rules, so I'm not sure if there's anything more they can do there to address this, like Huffman suggested.
Now, Biden's campaign has said, though, that he will be on the ballot. I mean, they seem to feel very strongly that he will get on the ballot.
Yeah, Biden's campaign has said that. Other Ohio Democrats have said that. I think, you know, they want to make it clear that there's, you know, things like this have come up before and have been resolved in the past. And so, you know, I don't think there's a lot of doubt that in the end it probably will get figured out. It's just a matter of what method they use.
Let's move to something else you've been covering, and it's a law that bans gender-affirming care in Ohio. Before we get into the current status of that, tell us what that law says and what it would do when enacted.
Yeah, so that law was set to take effect later this month, and it prohibits minors from getting gender-affirming care. That includes hormone therapy, puberty blockers, gender reassignment surgery, which, just a side note on the surgery piece, healthcare providers say that's not happening in Ohio. The bill also prohibits transgender women and girls from playing in female sports in high school and college. These were actually two separate bills once upon a time, but lawmakers combined them and passed them in one package last year.
So they passed them, but then the governor vetoed it, correct?
Yes, he thought it went too far and that, you know, decisions about this kind of medical care should be left to families. To sort of appease the legislature, he proposed some administrative rules that advocates and healthcare providers are also not happy about, but yeah, he did not want this legislation to take effect. Republicans in the House and Senate overrode his vetoes in January, so that allowed it to become law.
Now, the ACLU filed a challenge in court, and what did they say?
They say that this violates the Ohio Constitution, especially the healthcare piece. There's a part of the Ohio Constitution that says we have a right to health care, our own health care choices and insurance, which a fun tidbit is that was actually enacted as a result of concerns over the Affordable Care Act. They also say that the law violates what's called the single subject rule, which basically says bills have to be one topic. Now, lawmakers don't always do that and arguably violate that a lot. They pack a lot of stuff into different pieces of legislation, but the ACLU says this is a pretty blatant violation because these were, in fact, two different bills at one point.
Now, the ACLU has received an answer to its challenge, so at least a partial answer. What happened this week?
Yeah, so a Franklin County judge, who is a Republican, just side note, he granted a temporary injunction on this, so that temporarily blocks the law from taking effect. The injunction lasts for 14 days, but can be renewed if he sees fit. He agreed with arguments that the law could cause immediate harm to the two transgender girls who are the plaintiffs in this case. And he also thinks there's a pretty compelling case for the single subject rule. He noted that this was two bills once upon a time and thinks that it could be tossed out based on that. But, this is just one decision and a temporary one. So, definitely still a long way to go in this lawsuit.
What happens next?
Once the 14 days are up, we'll see if Judge Holbrook decides to re-up the temporary block, which he probably will just based on past practice in these kinds of cases. I'm not sure what the date is, but at some point there will be hearings for a preliminary injunction to kind of make a more decisive decision on this. I'm not quite sure what the timeline is for this. We've seen some of these lawsuits in other states play out for a while with different outcomes in the end. And of course, the Attorney General's office can always appeal decisions that they don't agree with. And I'm sure that will likely happen, particularly if a Franklin County court decides to permanently block the law.
So with the with this just being a temporary injunction for the 14 days, as you said, although it could be renewed, getting all of this through courts is going to take a whole lot more than 14 days. Do you anticipate that it would continually be renewed, the judge's ruling?
I think so. We've seen that happen a lot with abortion laws in Ohio, for example. The 6-week ban in Hamilton County, for example, I think got sort of delayed and then delayed again and delayed. So we see this a lot, especially when we're dealing with laws that are sort of on the brink of taking effect or not. So I basically think that this law will be blocked until, there's a final decision one way or the other on whether it should take effect.
And if it is determined that it cannot for the various reasons that you mentioned, would you anticipate they would try to bring it back again as two separate laws, so it's, a single subject as you talked about?
They could very well. There are lawmakers in the State House who feel really strongly about these issues. And I think, honestly, there are some who are more passionate about the athlete piece of this than the healthcare aspect. We'll see what happens, but I don't think they'll just abandon these issues altogether. There's also another bill going through the State House right now that would prevent transgender students from using bathrooms that align with their gender identity. So the issue of transgender rights in general is still a very heated topic in the legislature, and I certainly don't think it's going to go away.
Let's move on to another thing that you've covered this week, the sale of marijuana, and there have been some changes in how this will work. Tell us what's happened.
So, a lot of folks in the industry and a key lawmaker kind of at the center of these discussions thinks that sales could actually start this summer as early as June. The thinking for that is that applications for licenses have to go out in June under the state law, and stores that are already licensed for medical have basically gone through all the requirements that they need to. So, Representative Jamie Callender and some other operators I talked to think that for a lot of existing license holders, once these applications are available, it's going to be pretty easy for them to apply and get their license, and then they'll be pretty much ready to open their doors.
So what all do they have to do? Do they have to meet particular requirements? What are those?
Yeah, the state requires things like the locations have to be a certain distance from schools and churches, I think about 500 feet. There are rules for security and just how the facility should be set up. And in some ways, I think the medical program has been a lot stricter when it comes to those requirements. Not that there aren't also rules for recreational, but because of that, a lot of dispensary owners I've talked to who are already licensed are pretty comfortable that they'll be ready for rec.
What all they have to do? I mean, I know they have to set up, as you said, and follow those rules, but I mean, it's just a matter of setting up a store. How does that work?
Yeah, a lot of the existing medical dispensaries are have been really since December looking at their spaces, making sure they have enough room to accommodate increased demand, making sure they have enough staff, additional training to make sure that, new requirements are being followed, new cash registers and kiosks and things like that. A lot of this infrastructure is already in place. It's just a matter for them of scaling it up for a bigger customer base because they expect a lot more people to be wanting to use recreational versus the folks who are licensed for a medical card.
How many existing medical dispensaries are there? Do you know?
There's like 120 that are fully operational, I think, and then another 10 with provisional licenses, which means, they'll probably be up and running soon. They just have to tick off a few boxes before they can open their stores. So a good number out there. One of the problems with the medical program has been equitable access and ensuring that dispensaries are sufficiently spread out. I think some of those problems got resolved when the last round of medical licenses went out, but that is still an issue. So it's possible that, some businesses who are creating stores from scratch might be looking to areas of the state that don't have as much of a presence with marijuana, and, potentially trying to get into those markets.
So you said that the applications, they can start taking them June 7th. They have to be awarded by September 7th, but you think all of that could just move more quickly?
For the existing licensees, yeah. And I mean, in that, the Division of Cannabis Control isn't out here committing to any deadlines publicly. It's a lot of these other stakeholders that have been talking about it. But the thinking is that the division can move pretty quickly through these applications, whether they can, I guess we'll find out. And I certainly think too that it might not apply to every single dispensary. There may be some that are ready to go. There may be some that need a little bit more work if they need to do construction or bigger changes. So I think it depends. I think we're probably going to see a gradual rollout and gradual sales versus, 130 stores suddenly selling marijuana in June.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Great to be here.
We've been talking with political reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Haley B. Miller. In just a moment, we'll hear about the record number of tornadoes in Ohio this year and what you can do to be prepared. Stay with us. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Later in the program, we'll hear the status of a lawsuit involving a local UNESCO World Heritage Site, a device to help para-athlete train indoors, and what road construction you can expect this summer in Ohio. But first, joining me to talk about the number of tornadoes in Ohio this year, Fox 19 Chief Meteorologist Steve Horstmeyer. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. Nice looking day out there today, isn't
It is. And for everybody that wants to know, are we going to get any more rain?
Probably not today. I don't see anything on radar at the present time, and it looks like it's going to be dry now through the weekend, probably into Tuesday evening. So things are looking okay. And we're going to see a chilly weekend. So chilly mornings, cool afternoons, but if you don't want rain, you're going to be dry outside.
All right. Well, that sounds good to me. Let's talk about tornadoes, though. And even before it was officially tornado season, there were tornadoes in Ohio. What's going on?
Oh, I tell you, tornado season is one of those things that is kind of nebulous, and there's really no tornado season. Although even myself, we talk about it all the time. The peak of tornado occurrence is usually in the months of April, May, and June, and then the weather systems shift, and it usually becomes less common. Tornadoes have occurred in all months of the year, all times of the day. They just most often occur in the afternoon hours, taking advantage of the heat of the sun during the day. And then during the spring, which is when there's still some cold air left in Canada, there's a lot of warm air moving back to the north out of the Gulf of Mexico. And when those clash, we end up with more frequent storms and more frequent tornadoes. However, this was an El Nino winter. And if you look, we were almost 4 degrees warmer than normal for the 3-month period that we call meteorological winter, which is December, January, and February. And when you enter a spring season and all those objects, all that soil, all that water that usually gets really cold over the winter didn't get that cold, there's a lot of thermal energy available for the weather systems to use that would otherwise go into warming all that stuff back up. And so we just ended up with a spring that we were kind of primed for a severe weather season. Now, it's not the only factor, but it's certainly a big contributing factor that there's just a lot of heat around that didn't get absorbed or didn't get carried away by the winter winds and is now available to help drive storms.
Now, you know, the year that we had the most tornadoes was somewhere in the 90s. So it's not like, this is a huge, huge year, but it does seem like we are having more and more tornadoes in Ohio. Tornadoes number one on the list. You know, when you think of tornadoes, you think of Kansas, but Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, all very high on the list of places with a lot of tornadoes. Are things becoming more serious in this area, more of a concern for tornadoes than in the past?
It looks like that. The evidence kind of supports it, but nobody's really completely sure. Now, if you look at the geography of tornadoes, there's always been kind of another maximum. It's kind of center over the state of Indiana. And one of the reasons that the Cincinnati area and the Ohio River Valley has kind of that secondary maximum of tornadoes is oddly enough, because of the Appalachian Mountains. And as the warm, moist air surges northward out of the Gulf of Mexico, it has trouble getting over top of the Appalachian Mountains, so it can't spread out and go away. It just kind of gets concentrated to the west of the Appalachians, and that helps drive, all that warm, moist air helps drive additional thunderstorm and tornado activity. Okay, so we've kind of been set up geographically to have that, but when you combine the warm winter, when you combine also the concept of the warming planet, global warming, it looks like we're definitely going to see additional thunderstorm and tornado activity, and it seems like the belt that we call Tornado Alley is kind of shifting to the east. Now, nobody has really pinned that down yet, but there's certainly very good evidence to show that more and more tornadoes are occurring farther and farther east and north than they were before.
Well, so talk about what Tornado Alley is or was. What was that region? How would you describe it? What states?
Northern Texas into Oklahoma and Kansas, all the way up into Nebraska, and kind of a fuzzy boundary around most of the central and Great Plains. And it's a unique area. Not only do we have the Appalachian Mountains to the east of that, but we have the Rockies to the west. And so that factor that I talked about, concentrating moisture in between the mountains, helps. In addition, there is something called, it's called the dry line. I did my master's thesis on this years ago, but a lot of the southern plains often encounter desert air that comes in from northern Mexico, from Arizona, New Mexico, and kind of pushes in there. So you've got not only the cold air from Canada, the warm, moist air from the Gulf, but you've also got that desert dry air that works into this. And so those three factors combine to create a perfect environment for tornadoes to form in the southern and central plains. And that's why we call it Tornado Alley, because that's where they happen most of the time.
I've never heard of that. And you did a whole thesis about it. I have to go look that up, I think. That's pretty
interesting. It's been a long time.
Well, talk some more about global warming and what that just means in general for the shift. You've talked a lot about the effects of all of these, mountains and these sorts of things that cause that. Is this constant warming of the temperature? Our March was one of the warmest March on record. As that continues, do you think this is just going to make it worse and worse? Well, I don't know. Maybe people like tornadoes. I don't know that I do, but worse for the area in terms of getting more tornadoes?
I think not just tornadoes, but storms in general. That would include winter storms. But if we're specifically talking about tornadoes, the answer I say is yes. All the evidence supports that. And here's the main reasoning that kind of drives it. The most important source of energy for thunderstorms and tornadic thunderstorms is literally water vapor, or the humidity in the air. So every molecule of water that evaporates when it recondenses as it's traveling up in a thunderstorm gives back the heat that was originally used to do that evaporation. Now, to tie this to global warming, you've got to understand that the only real factor that controls how much water vapor is typically in the atmosphere globally on an average is the global temperature. And the warmer the planet gets, the more energy that's available to do the work of evaporation, the more moisture's in the air, and then there's more energy available for thunderstorms to lift that air, cool it, and release the heat. And so there's a direct connection between global warming and the number and intensity of storms, and that is water vapor.
Well, let's talk about that intensity. You know, you go from an F1 to, I don't know how, is it F5, the highest level you can
originally
get to?
Yeah, originally Ted Fujita, who developed the scale, had an F6 for an inconceivable tornado, but now it's confined to F0 through F5 for the scale.
And are we seeing more of those? Are we seeing more twos and threes and fours than supposedly, you know, just ones or straight line winds? I know we would hear about straight line winds.
It's a slight increase in the number of twos, threes. Fives are really so incredible that really hasn't been a noticeable increase in the number of really, really monster tornadoes. But the real increase is the smaller ones. And there's kind of a factor here that may negate some of what we think of as the increase in the number of tornadoes. And that's one is Doppler radar, and the other is that there's more people. So when I was a kid, in the 1950s and 60s, it was probably half the population there is now. So you had half of the number of opportunities for somebody actually seeing a tornado. So a lot of them went unreported. Nowadays, you not only have a lot more people, but those people have cell phones. There's a lot greater awareness. Everybody wants to be able to take a video of a tornado that's going by them. And so the combination of more people, the ability of them to record that, and kind of the essence that, hey, they're more aware of it, leads to an increased number of reports. The other technological factor here is Doppler radar. Things that we would have never seen in the 1980s and even early 1990s are seen routinely now. And so every time there's a little spin up Doppler radar, we'll say, hey, look at this, it's spinning. The National Weather Service meteorologists who are responsible for warning people see these much, much more often and in much more detail than they ever did. And now little bits of damage that would have otherwise just been attributed to winds, when they go investigate it, they find out there have been many small little EF0s and EF1 tornadoes. And so is it really increasing, or are we just better at seeing them? And that's one of the things that hasn't been resolved yet.
So that's sort of the, you know, if the tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound if there's nobody there to hear it? You know, I mean,
it's one of those.
So that being the case, nevertheless, there are still plenty of tornadoes, it seems, and we need to talk about how to be prepared. And I think most people know, hey, go to your basement. But is there anything you can do even in advance of this bad weather that could help you out when the tornado comes through?
And it's always a matter of being aware and being prepared. So the first thing you need to do is you need to decide what you're going to do when the storm is approaching. So you don't have to think, you don't have to move things around. You just react and go to what we call the safe spot in general. And then, of course, once you have that safe spot set up, you know where to go and you know just to get there without having to do a bunch of other stuff, you've got to be aware. And for years, we've had weather radio, we've had the sirens, which are specifically set up for people who are out of doors. And now you've got weather apps and TV and the internet, and you've got many, many, many ways to find out about it. So on a day when storms are forecast, it's best just to be weather aware, is the term we all use frequently. And if you're weather aware, if you're paying attention and the opportunity comes up to get to your safe spot, you just go there without having to think. And, you know, and unfortunately, there are some spots where there just aren't safe spots in some cases.
Well, I was going to ask that. I mean, what do you do if you're driving?
Well, the conventional wisdom is to try to outrun it, but that's not going to work because if you're on a busy highway, you're just liable to end up in a traffic jam. Your best bet is just to stay in your vehicle. However, that's not necessarily a really safe spot. It's even worse. And most of the people who are seriously injured or killed in tornadoes when they directly encounter them are killed by flying debris. And so your car would offer a degree of protection over being out in the open, but it's certainly not an ideal place to be.
When I was a kid, I remember hearing, "No, get out of your car and go into a ditch along the side of the road. That's safer." Is that not safer?
Well, actually, it is. However, the problem is when you if you're taking the time to get out of your car and try to find a ditch and get there, you're exposing yourself to danger. But when I advise people, if you're out in the open, you're not in your car, the best thing is to lay in a ditch because think about it, most of that debris is blown along the ground, and if you are slightly below the average ground level, there's less of a chance that you would end up being struck by some blowing debris. So a ditch is a good place, unless the ditch happens to be a creek that's going to fill up with flooding waters. I mean, so there are
All
a
right.
lot of complications here. And as a person who's outdoors a lot, that I'm saying that, yeah, if you're outdoors, that's great. But if you're in the middle of a traffic jam on Interstate 71, you don't try and run to the side and find a ditch because the blowing debris would, and you would encounter that first.
So just stay in your car. If you have a basement, obviously that's the best bet. There are plenty of homes
Absolutely.
that don't have basements. What do you recommend for? I was worried my daughter's in college in an apartment, and the weather was really bad a few weeks ago. And I'm like, "Do you know where to go?" And I sent her to a campus building so she could go into a basement there. I'm like, "Don't, please don't be in your apartment." What do you do if you're in an apartment?
Your best bet is to find a room that an interior room, a closet, because typically it's stronger there because it's smaller and there's more structure and concentrated in an area. You want to stay away from glass. If you're sitting in your living room in an apartment and you've got a big glass window, all that glass that's broken just turns into shards that can be very, very dangerous. So what you want to do is you want to an interior hallway. Interior closet away from glass. And the old standby is jump in the bathtub if you have an old bathtub. As a matter of fact, a former anchor at Fox 19, Jessica Brown, who's now in Boston, she was in Missouri during a terrible tornado down there. She did just that. She dragged some stuff over top of her in her bathroom, and when everything calmed down, she took I guess it was a mattress off of her and looked out, and the wall of her bathroom was gone. And she was on the second story looking out over all the other damage. But being
Oh
in that
my.
bathtub actually saved her. And bathrooms with plumbing and all that tend to be a little bit stronger structure also.
Wow. Well, that's a lot to think about there. We're just about out of time. Any last minute tips?
Stay aware. And I don't want to, kind of hawk our weather app, but any weather app you've got will do a great job at warning you and letting you know when something's coming your way. And weather apps nowadays, they actually track you. So it's not going to give you a tornado warning that is 40 miles away. It knows where you are and it will let you know if something's coming into your immediate vicinity. So the new technology that we have really helps you stay aware.
Steve, thank you so much. You've been really helpful. I appreciate it.
I'm glad to help out.
I've been talking with Fox 19 chief meteorologist Steve Horsmeyer. In just a moment, the latest on a lawsuit connected to a local site recently designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And how much road construction will we see in Ohio this summer? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Last year, Ohio's Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks was designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But it's also been facing a lawsuit. Joining me to talk about the latest on that suit is WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Hey, Tana.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Describe what this UNESCO suit is all about.
Okay, so the UNESCO World Heritage Site that was designated in Ohio is actually made up of a bunch of locations of Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks. These are earthen mounds that were created 1,000 to 2,000 years ago, and they're sacred historical sites. Now they're World Heritage Sites. But one of the locations in the grouping of locations is called the Octagon, and it's currently there's currently a golf course on it. And there's been a golf course on it for 100 years or so, maybe not quite that long, but for a long time. And back when all of this started, that they were going to have the they were going to go for World Heritage status, essentially they realized it's not going to look good that to have a golf course operating on a sacred site. So Ohio History Connection ultimately is who owns that land. They'd been leasing it to the golf course, and they went all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court, and the Ohio Supreme Court said, yes, you can take that land back by eminent domain, but you have to pay the golf course for the country. You have to play the country club for the golf course. So that trial was supposed to start in October of 2023, last year. As part of that, the Ohio History Connection got an estimate for how much, you know, their experts said you should pay about $2 million for this. The country club's experts said it's closer to about $22 million.
That's a big difference.
It is a big difference. But the key factor there is that the experts for the country club factored in the value of the earthworks themselves, which obviously made it much more valuable. But the judge in the case, this case is in Licking County, where the Octagon is, the judge in the case said, no, I told you, you can't include that value. You can only have the value of the course. So he threw out all of their proposed witnesses. So the country club then appealed to the Fifth District Court of Appeals, which said, well, that's not an appealable order, so try again. No, thank you.
Can't appeal.
So then, of course, the country club, which is Mound Builders Country Club, went again to the Ohio Supreme Court, which this week said, we decline to take jurisdiction of this appeal.
So they won't hear the case.
So where does that leave us, right?
Right, where does that leave us?
So the case then goes back to the judge in Licking County. You know, what will actually happen now? I don't know. I did check in with the judge because that's where it goes. It goes back to the court in Lincoln County, but we're not really sure how that's going to proceed. I did call the judge's office. They're in the middle of a murder trial right now, so they haven't really done anything with it as of earlier this week. And we did reach out to Mound Builders Country Club, attorneys from Mound Builders Country Club, and have not heard back. Obviously, we did hear from Ohio History Connection, who are pleased with the decision.
And there we have it.
Yes.
Not quite in a nutshell, because that's complicated.
It is a long story. And whenever I sit down to write it, where do I start?
Right. And how do you get all that background in?
Yes.
Oh, goodness. Well, thanks for filling us in on that. You also this week had the opportunity, I'll call it an opportunity, to go to a news conference about summer construction, road construction in the state of Ohio. What are we going to expect? Is it going to be a big year for road construction?
Well, there are certainly a lot of projects all across the state. The state's going to spend about $2.8 billion on more than 950 road and bridge projects. Locally, which we're in District 8, Preble, Hamilton, Butler, Claremont,
Warren,
and one more up closer to Dayton, maybe Green. Are all in District 8. So locally, they're going to spend about $300 million on 220 projects. So okay. A lot of money, a lot of orange barrels.
That's right. Lots to deal with. Well, one of the projects I know a lot of people in this area are interested on, including our engineer for the show today, Marshall Verbsky, who said, oh, what is happening with the Norwood Lateral? They've closed it down in one direction, and then that'll reopen, and then they're going to close the other direction. And what's happening?
All right. So the good news from Ohio Department of Transportation is the Norwood Lateral project is going well. It is on schedule. Actually, it's maybe a little bit ahead of schedule. So the big news out of that news event, I guess, was that the Norwood Lateral might be open both directions for Memorial Day holiday weekend traffic.
So they will keep it open and not close the other half.
Right. They'll wait to flip. So they're doing eastbound right now. That's the side that's closed. That's going well. It should be finished by Memorial Day, so it could be open for Memorial Day traffic, and then they won't start westbound because they're going to close westbound and do the same thing. They won't start westbound until after Memorial Day.
And when's it supposed to be done? Do you know?
So they're going to be finished. They expect to be finished with the westbound side of it by August or September. but the whole project actually won't. So it'll be open again by August or September, but the whole project won't be done until June of 2025, you know, all the finishing touches and whatnot. So still a little bit more work to come after that, but not the massive shutdown that we're dealing with right now.
Okay, Marshall, I hope you heard that. Okay, so that's what we have, and construction season, and expect orange barrels, and it's just...
Especially 75 and 74, those are going to continue to be huge projects in our area. Over on 71, the Kennedy Interchange, they're starting work on that. Also out in the Claremont County area, the Glen Estee Withamsville project, the State Route 32, and a new interchange at Bach Buxton, those were some of the other ones they flagged as being, you know, big projects.
Summer in Ohio. We grow orange barrels. You also did a story this week talking about an athlete who is a para athlete, a hand cyclist, and very talented, very skilled, really at the top of his sport. But one of the problems that he has come into is that training when it's raining has become really difficult for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's not difficult. So our colleague Nick Swartzel, who is a big cyclist himself, sort of pointed out, well, why can't he just bike in the rain? And he can bike in the rain, but the kicker here is that he's an elite athlete and he doesn't always want to bike out on the roads. The problem is he has no stationary trainer. So, you know, any other cyclist might just take their bike and put it on a stationary trainer. You know, kind of pop off a front wheel maybe or a back wheel, put it in a training device, and then you can, you know, just bike while you're, you know, in your living room. Mm-hmm. So this athlete, his name is Omar Duran. He can't do that. There is no such stationary trainer for his hand cycle. So he sits in a little bucket seat and he pedals, if you will, with his hands and arms.
Okay, so that's how that works. And he would like to be able to do that. There's no way to do that. So when you have this problem, where do you go for an answer?
There's this program called QL Plus, or Quality of Life Plus. Someone, a friend of the station, I guess, if you will, someone who does some freelance photography work for us, his name is Jason Whitman. He is a veteran, and QL Plus works with veterans and universities all across the country to pair injured veterans or wounded veterans with universities to help them find solutions to whatever their problem may be. So Jason is friends with Omar because they're both cyclists, and he thought, what about, you know, what can we do for you? And Omar said, I need a stationary trainer. So they went to the University of Cincinnati's engineering department, and three seniors took this on as their capstone project to build a stationary trainer for Omar.
And the Capstone Project, it's their senior year, right? They're all in the end of their program. And so you got to talk to some of these students.
Yeah.
And this part I thought was pretty interesting. They seemed, I don't know, Capstone Projects, I think, are a lot of work, I think.
Yeah.
I hear my daughter talking about hers all the time. She's loving it, if the professor is loving every minute of it. But they're a lot of work, and you have to put a lot of effort in, and it's not always something you're particularly enthusiastic about it. How do these students feel?
So that is something that wasn't actually in the story. These QL Plus pitches their projects to students, and students say, yes, we would want that. It's not the students, you know, having to come up with an idea. So that is actually interesting. These students said, we will take that project. We want to do that. And they, a lot of their colleagues, you know, fellow students maybe have theoretical projects. They're coming up with theoretical solutions. They might make a prototype. This is something that the students told me, no, we're going to make this and it's going to work. And graduation is at the end of April. And if it's not done by then, we're going to stick around and make sure that we can deliver this project to Omar so that he can use it. It is a real life thing. It's not some sort of theoretical exercise. Could this happen?
So they seem pretty excited about it.
Yeah. And it seems pretty neat. They weren't trying to reinvent the wheel, I suppose, to be somewhat punny. They took something called a kicker. Lots of bicycle terminology about to happen, which is a thing that's in a bike. So pre-made bike.
Wait a minute. Can we mark that down? Tana called it a thing that's in a bike. Okay, that's good. The kicker.
They took a bunch of bike parts that already pre-existed and then alternated the way they are used. So they kind of flipped it upside down. Normally a kicker would be right side up and it would pedal like the back wheel of your bike. The hand cycle works in opposition to that, the upside. So they turned it upside down and used some pieces that Omar already had. And hopefully pretty soon it will be done.
All right. So has he seen it in process?
Yeah. So that's when I met him on the eclipse day. He was in town on eclipse day to meet with the students to go over the prototype as far as it was so far and work with them. And so then I think they'll keep working on it. Yeah.
Now, if you want to see some pictures, we have those on the website, right?
We do have some pictures. Great pictures. Thanks to Jason Whitman. And you can also see Omar racing. I guess we should explain Omar is a veteran. He was wounded in Afghanistan, blown off a cliff. And so is paralyzed from the waist down. But he's one of the most, not most elite, he's an elite athlete. Jason was saying he's one of the fastest hand cyclists in the world. He can make, 1,200 watts with just his arms and hands, which doesn't necessarily mean anything to you or me. But he explained that pro cyclists at the Tour de France are doing 1,200 watts. And he equated it to an 800 horsepower car. And he's doing that with his arms and his hands.
That's incredible.
Yes. He's been in the Paralympic Games. He's been to Rio and some other places. He told me he just made the cut, so he won't be in the Olympic Games this summer in France, in Paris, but he is training for something called Race Across America. And their goal, this is you bike from coast to coast, and he's on a team, and their goal is to do it in under 7 days. Wow. Which is just mind-boggling.
That is absolutely true. Well, WVXU.org to see some of those pictures. Before we wrap up, though, rumor has it that you stayed up late last night and listened to Taylor Swift's new album. My daughter would be proud.
Yes, yes, yes. I was up at midnight to listen to the Tortured Poets Department. I'm
so
old.
Society.
I do too. I have a Dead Poets Society. It's not Robin Williams' movie. It is a Taylor Swift album. And then I guess all the Swifties knew this. They were, you know, she was dropping little hints about two everywhere. And then at 2 a.m., she dropped another album. So it's a whole anthology. It's like a little over 2 hours worth of music. So this morning I had to wake up and start listening to the second act, half of the album.
And how was it?
It's pretty good. It's not necessarily my jam. She's a little angsty for me. I like the more poppy sound, but of course everybody is loving it. There are some good ones. I like The Alchemy. So you can join me on Twitter or on Threads and we can discuss which songs are the best.
The other thing to talk about with that, apparently rumor has it, and I've read this in a bunch of places. I have no idea if this is true. So as a journalist, I'm going to admit,
full disclosure,
I have no idea if this is true, but apparently one of the songs is about Travis Kelce.
I heard some like rumor discussion about this too. I don't know. The article I read said, you know, like the forward looking, because it was written before she would have been dating the Kelce brother. So The Alchemy, which I said was my favorite so far, might be that one. I don't know though. I have to go back and listen.
We'll find out more
research.
We will find out. Thank you, Tana.
Thank you.
Yeah, real research, like we have the facts. I've been talking with WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner, who usually is very good about all the facts. I'm the one that's leading her astray. Producer of Cincinnati Edition is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Thanks for being here.